Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is The Two Matts for week ending Friday, the 12th of October. A dissenting voice, but also a voice for positive change. And what voices? What do you sound like, Matt? Who do you sound like? You're a man of many voices when you want to.
A man of a thousand voices. Unfortunately, this week it's got to be a slightly somber voice because we talked about Israel, and then we talked to the brilliant Fiona Miller about education and the Labour conference. I guess it's been a podcast about going back to first principles, really.
And it's a serious one. So a bit of a content warning. There are some graphic descriptions of violence, I'm afraid, but that's because we have woken up into a particularly violent era right now, I'm afraid. So check the show notes for more details on that. What are we going to call the episode this week?
Horror and Hope, or
Back to Square One.
Back to Square One, let's call it that.
Back to Square One.
Very apt.
So this is The Two Matts, episode 17, Back to Square One. So, Matt, unfortunately, only one real topic to open the show with this week.
Yeah, and it's an appalling one. And I guess my first reaction on Saturday as news started to filter through was horror, but also a sense of mild dismay, because I think there are some horrors of a scale that need, in the first instance, just to be reported upon and apprehended and considered in and of themselves. So, you know, without recourse to yes, but, or, you know, this is Netanyahu's fault, or it's a terrible failure of intelligence, though it may well be. This is more Jews died on Saturday than on any day since the Holocaust.
Yeah,
wow. It's a huge, historic, tragic day. And I think it's really important, probably for a bit, actually, to treat this in sequence and deal with that. Because, you know, after all, on September the 12th, you didn't have lots of people saying this is all the fault of the American intelligence community and it's high time that George W. Bush got round a table with Osama bin Laden, even though questions of that character were asked later on.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we're recording this on Thursday. It's less than a week since, and body bags are still being filled.
Yeah.
It's important to get the measure, I think, first of the sheer horror of what's happened.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think what's maybe part of the kind of reason that we've got all these different voices at the moment speaking in what seems to be quite incoherent and confused manner about what the proper response is to what's just happened is that there is, I think, I'm probably speaking for myself in that this has been going on for so long and it's so complicated and so confusing that there's a kind of automatic margin of, like, I don't know it's confusing and there are different forces at work here and I know that there's no 100% bad guys and 100% good guys. It didn't happen in isolation like September the 11th happened in isolation. No. Boom, out of this clear blue sky. It feels like it's risen out of a chronic a persistently chronic problem. And therefore, a lot of people are going, oh my God, this is awful, but it has been awful for a long time. This is now even more awful. And then there are people who are entrenched in camps on either side, yes, who are using it as capital, frankly, you know.
And you're right that one, at such moments, people rely on a kind of lazy muscle reflex, muscle memory,
right,
and they revert to. So, you know, had people tweeting saying this is what decolonization looks like.
Right.
No, it isn't. I always think it's helpful in these sort of situations to work out what it isn't. Mm-hmm. So I went to see Golda, the new movie about the Yom Kippur War, and Golda Meir this year, which is interesting. It's 73. This coincided with the 50th anniversary.
That's right.
And in fact, this is totally different to Yom Kippur. It's not tanks rolling into the Sinai or across the Golan Heights. Nor was it another intifada. You know, I think our generation was very, very influenced by the intifadas, plural, and the sight of young, desperate Palestinian youths throwing rocks at Israeli troops marching towards
That's
them.
Right.
This was not that. This was hyper-modern terrorism. Mm. And
ISIS style.
You know, yeah, this was against civilians and, crucially, advertised on social media, which is a really, really big and important detail.
Yeah.
You know, even the Nazis tried to conceal what they'd done to the Jewish people. And I think what people I've spoken to in Israel during the intervening time find truly unbelievable is that I think they feel that you had to go to social media to find out what was happening, because the mainstream media was lagging behind, and rather like The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman, that great book about the First World War, fighting the last war, or wars before.
Yeah.
And this is a really, really, it's a very modern conflict that we're now observing. You have Hamas, who are a Islamist force that is clearly prepared to do anything in fact wants to be as brutal as it possibly can and has been, backed by Iran. And, you know, yes, of course, there'll be as there was after the Yom Kippur War, the Agranat Commission after that, there will be a big inquiry into what went wrong, why were the security services sleeping, you know, what went wrong. But it also shows that one of Netanyahu's big mistakes was to underestimate Hamas, because there was real tradecraft involved in this incursion. You know, there was cyber warfare of some kind. There were drones. There was
fucking people paragliding in.
Immaculate planning.
You know, but also, you know, like that festival, I think, which is probably one of the things that has touched more people. You know, 260 young people dancing away in a festival site. People going in like a fucking video game, slaughtering them.
Yes.
And videoing it and showing the clips of dead bodies on social media and stuff like this. This is absolutely beyond the pale of humanity, isn't it?
I mean, I think that the Nova rave, where you said, as you said, 260 people were killed, and then the horrors that are still emerging from the Kfar Aza kibbutz, you know, we know that at least 40 babies were murdered in their cribs.
Yeah, and on that point, right, so this is how weird the conversation has become in this country, I think, is that you've got people who are, you know, either very pro-Palestinian. There's a woman who works for an independent media site. I won't name her or the site because she's since apologized for it. And she immediately tweeted, this is a day of celebration, right? 3 days later, she apologizes and says, I think under some pressure from her colleagues saying, I got that wrong, blah, blah, blah. So sorry about that. Okay, 3 days, well done. But in another tweet, somebody said, oh, you're celebrating the decapitation of babies, are you? You heartless so-and-so, right? And then she, in response, retweeted something saying, a piece of intelligence saying that maybe they weren't beheaded, right? So, oh, no, that's a lie, you know? And I thought, this is what you've come to now. Is
where the argument is
you're
over.
You're claiming the moral high ground because of whether the babies were shot in the face or decapitated.
The means by which babies were killed becomes the area of contestation.
That's right.
Something has gone
it
very
is
badly
mad. It's
wrong.
Madness.
It is madness. It's decadence and madness. And it worries me immensely because whatever else comes out of this, the stakes are hugely high. And obviously they're primarily high for the people of Israel, and they're going to be high indeed they already are, for the Palestinians who are, you know, ruled by Hamas, you know, and haven't had an election since 2006, that, you know, there's going to be huge consequences for them. But also, you know, there's part of me that hopes the Wall Street Journal is wrong and that Iran was not the force planning this. Yeah. Although I have to say, you know, the history of Hamas is such that it would be odd if Tehran was not involved, because...
Well, they have to be, sure.
They have to be, because yeah. And therefore the capacity for escalation in this crisis, you know, not to speak of what will happen as a direct consequence of the massacres immediately, is huge and geopolitical.
And by the way, thank God we've got Joe Biden as president of the US right now and not Donald Trump.
Well, exactly.
Because we'd be deep into Axis of Evil territory by now.
And flailing around. Yeah. I mean, there is, I have to say, I'm told, quite a division at the apex of the US administration between Biden, who's a kind of old school, pro-Israel, Washington, old hand, right?
Yeah.
And his response is, this will not stand, this is wrong. And he mobilizes the new aircraft carrier, the Gerald Ford,
yeah,
and about you know, a whole range of F-15s and F-16s into theater. Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, has gone to Israel to try and calm
things down.
Because his view, much more than Biden's, is that, you know, the if this escalates to Hezbollah in the north,
yeah,
if this brings Iran in, if the kind of the regional you know, still fragile piece of the Abraham Accords with Bahrain and the UAE and thawing relations with Saudi falls to pieces, which I think is one of the primary objectives of this assault, there is the scope for this to degenerate into something that goes way beyond the borders of, yeah, Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. So, you know, we're watching a very, very dangerous arc, which is Biden pulls out of Afghanistan, you know, and his message to the world is America is no longer the policeman of the world. I want to withdraw from wars and not end them. You know, it's a benign version of Trump's flailing.
Yeah.
And indeed of Obama's.
Yeah.
But there's now a war in Ukraine. And Zelensky is now competing,
yeah,
with Israel for Patriot missiles.
Bad news for Zelensky.
Very bad news.
Great
for Zelensky.
News for Putin. This.
You have Putin. We already know helping with the cyber attacks, and you know, we know he has close relations with Iran and so on. So the West is, whether it likes it or not, suddenly involved in a two-theater war to some extent. It's not fighting directly yet in either. Conflict, but it is,
yeah,
facing that. So suddenly, you know, people were talking about American isolationism with reason. Now we're looking at you know, new forms of 21st century warfare that are sprouting up all over the place. And the stakes are way beyond, you know, what does this mean for a two-state solution? I mean, I'm afraid the answer to that is nothing good. And I said to someone last night that, you know, I'm 55, I now wonder if which I didn't until Saturday, whether there would be a two-state solution in my lifetime, which, yeah, is a very melancholy reflection.
What, yeah, happens? I mean, the timing of it is, you know, weird as well, because of course Israel was talking to Saudi Arabia,
exactly,
about,
yeah,
you know, putting, you know, things were moving forward in a kind of very glacial as ever way, but there was progress being made, and this, of course, has completely pulled the rug
and was designed to
everybody's feet. And but it just seems like, I know this is such an inane observation, but the people who are really screwed now are the people who are the civilians in Gaza. You know, they are, you know, now they are going to reap the whirlwind in some way, shape or form. It's entirely understandable.
Well, I would say,
how does Hamas coexist with people in their civilians?
Now we're at the bone, I think, which, yeah, is that civilians on either side of the line are, yeah, living in an intolerable situation, which is the whole point of the State of Israel is it's the place where Jewish people can go to be safe.
Yes.
Israeli citizens more than at any point, I think, since Yom Kippur and possibly before, really don't feel that. Jews living outside Israel aren't feeling that. You know, there are horrible stories of people at Jewish schools taking off their blazer.
Yeah. Not wearing the kippahs.
And so on. So that's them.
Yeah.
And, you know, they are still mourning their dead. And we don't know the death toll yet. On the other side, the Palestinian people are faced with a serious problem, which is there is no way that Israel is not going to take very strong action already. Yeah. And that's a given. You know, it's going to happen.
But they're talking about leveling the place.
Right.
People living in tents in Gaza.
Right.
That'll be
right. Yeah. So the question is there a way of, and this does involve international assistance, even if it's covert, is there a way of, let's put it politely, removing Hamas from the equation in the way that ISIS was removed, at least for now, from the equation in 2019? I don't know the answer to that.
So, I mean, but that would involve, I mean, I heard talk about, oh, America's going to send in bunker buster bombs to wipe the tunnels out and all. But you can't do that without destroying entire neighbourhoods.
The problem is that, as you imply, is that what Hamas has done is it's infiltrated the whole of, you know, Gaza, yeah, literally and
it's
figuratively.
It's infected the entire place.
Right.
It's a contagion.
So, you know, they have hidden weaponry and so on in areas of high population, and it's most parts of Gaza are high population density. How do you decapitate the Hamas leadership without killing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians?
Of innocence, yeah.
Query. You know, I mean, one thing that could be done, and this is a huge diplomatic ask, but a large part of the Hamas leadership is in Qatar.
Yes.
And we saw,
what's the relationship there? That's so strange.
It is very strange, because on the one hand, Qatar wants to, you know, normalize relationships with Israel, but on the other, it's playing host to, you know, we saw that extraordinary shot of Hamas leaders in suits in Qatar celebrating the attacks. You know, all of those should be extradited and tried at The Hague.
Yeah.
Will they be? Probably not. But that's the kind of imaginative step that the international community could take. Because Israel now has a situation where, far from thinking Netanyahu went too hard, they're saying he didn't go hard enough.
That's right.
And I don't think this is necessarily good news for Netanyahu strategically, but tactically it's enabled him to form a government of national unity. And for the time being, he's in charge. He will direct the hostilities. Yeah. So we have to work with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not a patient or a forgiving man. And he's under huge pressure from a population that says, but you said you could contain Hamas.
Yeah. And you messed up, mate. Yeah.
And he didn't.
Yeah.
So the stakes on every level are enormously high. And that's why, just to circle back to where we started, I think it's incredibly important for those of us sort of analysing it, looking at it, not to retreat into ideological comfort zones. Because, as you say, there's huge complexity, and there's also novelty in this. You know, it's good. If in doubt, I was saying, journalism, report. You know, look at the facts on the ground rather than apply, you know, the ideology that might have made sense in the Second Intifada, or when Sharon was withdrawing from Gaza back in 2006.
And there are too many people, I think, who are in our profession who are using this as a moment to make some dogmatic case for they've been right for a long time. It's not a football game. Okay, well, on that note, I hope that's not been too depressing. We're going to move on to the next half, where we're going to talk to the brilliant Fiona Miller about education.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
We're delighted to be joined this week by Fiona Miller, education activist, mm-hmm. campaigner, activist, and journalist, mm-hmm. regular
Welcome.
Writer for
Welcome.
The Guardian.
Thank you.
And occasional writer for the New European.
Yeah.
Like that to
yeah,
be a bit
yeah.
more regular, please, Fiona.
Yeah.
This week we've had Keir Starmer's speech, which I thought was excellently delivered and, mm-hmm. you know, had a lot of good stuff in it. A big part of it was about education. Mm-hmm. You wrote a big piece in The Guardian in...
Actually, should we have a quick taste of that?
That's right? a good yeah, idea. Yeah. Let's have a taste of Keir's speech. Sir Keir's speech.
Sir Keir.
You know, I never thought I would hear a modern Conservative Prime Minister say that 50% of our children going to university was a false dream. My dad felt the disrespect of vocational skills all his life. But the solution is not, and never will be, the levelling down of working class aspiration to go to university.
So there he is talking about universities. We'll touch on that as well. But obviously the education system in the UK has chronically been a problem. You wrote a great piece in The Guardian in August, I think, mm-hmm. saying, you know, what Labour should be doing about education. How much of what Keir Starmer said answered those points you were making, and what should he do? What should he do to fix education in the UK?
Well, I had some specific proposals for him, but I think what I was trying to say was that there were a lot of very atomised proposals, like a bit of oracy here, a bit of tech there, a bit of this digital, but didn't add up to a kind of coherent narrative about. And I think the speech did have a coherent narrative about what he was about, and explaining a bit about this class ceiling. Although, interestingly, I spoke at a head teacher conference 2 weeks ago and I said, does anybody here know what Labour's education slogan is? And nobody had a clue. So there's a bit of work to be done to kind of ram that home. And the way you do that is by repeating it, but with some very clear proposals to go alongside it. And I think, you know, I agree with both of the things he was saying there. University should always be an aspiration for everybody. But the inequality between academic qualifications and technical qualifications has always bedeviled the English system. And I'm not quite sure that we're there yet with the solutions to that particular problem. And I'd want to know more about what Labour's really going to do, because it's all very well saying we're going to have technical colleges, et cetera, et cetera. But if you hold up the A-level as the gold standard, most kids will think that's the thing they should go for.
I mean, that's what I was going to ask you, Fiona, about that, was my very first job, staff job on a newspaper was as an education correspondent. And, you know, this is early 90s. And back then, Tory ministers were talking about parity of esteem between technical and vocational qualifications on the one hand and A-levels and university on the other. And here we are, and it hasn't happened.
No.
Is it... I mean, it requires, doesn't it, a massive cultural shift, both in government and beyond.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost comic if you go back and look at the number of qualifications that have been, technical qualifications that have been invented since the Second World War. I mean, you probably can't remember the names of all of them, but there are loads.
T-levels,
that's the latest one. You know,
yeah.
BTEC, TVI. You know, every so often somebody invents a new one. Nobody can remember them. They don't last very long, but the A-level rolls on and on and on. So I think that is a problem. But that's why in the piece I was also saying that I'm very attracted to this baccalaureate idea, although somebody says to me, oh, that polls very badly with the public because they think it's foreign. Well, it is a kind of foreign word. But the idea that you have a kind of group toward you know, a diploma at 18, which a lot of countries do, a final qualification. And within that, you can have an academic or vocational qualification. So nobody will say, oh, you've got academic or you've got vocational. They say, you've all got your diploma, but people will have diplomas to a different level and they will incorporate different things.
Just explain that, because I'm unfamiliar with the baccalaureate systems. Yeah. But and I, until you said that, I was assuming it was one kind of examination or something that you had to pass. But you could, as a student, if I am more inclined towards something that's going to be vocational, I can choose that to be my baccalaureate. Is that
well,
the
best known one is the International Baccalaureate, and that specifically was set up after the Second World War, and it was to include things like citizenship and, you know, humanity and lots of broader aims for people. And that I find very attractive, but that's quite an academic model. But I mean, theoretically, you could create a baccalaureate, which is really a grouped award, which is just a sort of label that holds within it lots of other qualifications, including whatever you wanted. And I mean, you'll remember the Mike Tomlinson proposals in 2004, and that was for a diploma. It was going to take 10 years to bring it in. Yeah. And that diploma would have included academic and vocational qualifications and so much more, you know, dance, creativity, civic action, whatever you wanted to put in it. But, you know, the first headline was, oh, you know, Blair's going to get rid of the gold standard A level, and everybody took fright and they didn't do it. We could have been there by now, but here we are again. And now Sunak's got his advanced British standard, which is, nobody knows what that means.
Well,
either.
I think it's in response to your point about people, for some reason, finding the word baccalaureate
foreign.
You know, alarmingly foreign, which is a bit worrying.
We didn't vote for Brexit.
No, that's right.
To have a baccalaureate, to have escargot. But I suppose one of the things that, as always at a Labour conference that precedes an election, there's a lot about aspiration. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that one of the problems with that word is that it tends to come across as actually A-levels in university and professional life. That's aspiration.
In the UK it does, yeah.
In the UK. And how you change the meaning of that word so that you can aspire to be, you know, a fantastic, you know, a person in a trade or in a vocation. It sounds like a small detail, but actually it seems to me a big lift that. Because A-levels are still seen as, you know, what every young person should aspire to.
Yeah, I think it's very, very difficult, which is why ultimately I think you've got to get rid of GCSEs and A-levels and just have one final qualification. That's the only probably way you'll do it. But the transition to that would be to include all the qualifications under one final award, as it were. And I think I think it was a little bit disappointing that when Sunak floated his baccalaureate idea, Labour immediately came in, well, we are in an election year, said, oh, that's rubbish, we can't do that because we don't have enough teachers. Well, that's true, but in theory, with the right investment and the right structure, you could do it. And I think Labour should, if they wanted to have an imaginative way forward that would resolve this problem, they should be thinking about that. We don't need GCSEs. They were invented for an era when kids left school at 16 and they don't do that anymore.
On the subject of...
Even the guy who invented them, Ken Baker, is in favour of
On the subject of investment in schools... You know, we've just had the whole RARC concrete scandal. It's obvious that the public estate in schools and elsewhere is in desperate condition. We are going to need investment. Now, Starmer's kind of mantra throughout this conference was, yes, but that investment is going to come from growth. And he said on the Victoria Derbyshire show, or Laura Koonsberg show with Victoria Derbyshire standing in, that he was very confident that this could happen very quickly. Do you think that the fact of a Labour government will lead to growth? Is that enough to satisfy you? Or what do you think about that?
Well, I don't think the growth is going to come quickly to resolve the schools funding crisis.
What I'm
driving at. As a governor of several schools,
yes.
I can tell you that schools are going into deficit now.
Right.
And once they're going into deficit, and that's only on the revenue side, that's not on the capital side, which is a whole different part of the school budget. So, I mean, hopefully Labour will get more growth. But, you know, you're not going to get more growth unless you resolve this situation of technical and skills education, because you've got to get more productivity. And at the moment, we're just not turning out the sort of young people who are going to go and do those jobs and do them in a very productive way, in the way that other countries do. And that's because our education system still considers, you know, a degree in classics at Oxford the ultimate, you know, hallmark of aspiration.
What's changed? I didn't go to university. And
good for you.
I wanted to.
You've got a long way in life, so it does prove.
But what happened instead was I left school after doing dismally at my A-levels and then became a cub reporter on a newspaper and spent 4 years learning newspaper trade. And that was my university degree, if you like. Why is it, what's changed? There was no, my point is there was no stigma then about not going to university. It was a nice thing. Yeah. People were very proud of it, but nobody thought you'd failed if you didn't. Now I think, when I think about my kids going through A-levels, I wouldn't want to put a burden on them, but I would think, oh, well, that's a shame they haven't gone to university. Mm. What's changed in the national psyche that university has become this...
Well, we made that the aspiration, didn't we? And I think Tony Blair made that the aspiration in particular. And I agree with that. When I went to university, only 10% of the population went to university.
Right.
And that really has changed. There is an expectation. I think Michael Gove came along and he had this thing called facilitating subjects. I don't know if you remember that particular period where you had to do these facilitating subjects at A-levels. Otherwise, you wouldn't get into the good universities. In fact, that wasn't strictly true. But I used to hear kids walking down the street, you know, sometimes working class kids I know from my community saying, well, I've got to have a facilitating subject in my A-levels. So everything was being recalibrated all the time. Yes. But this sort of political rhetoric, which was really part of a game, it wasn't necessarily in the best interest of the young people. But I think we shouldn't forget the social and emotional benefits of going to university.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of parents and young people now see that as an opportunity to then be able to go somewhere and grow up a bit and have some yeah. time to grow up and have other experiences, meet other people. I'll just tell you one story, because you'll like this, this friend of ours who comes from the northwest of England, and everybody in his community, he says, is so pro-Brexit and he can't get on with any of them. And he said the thing that changed him was going away to university right. and meeting people from different backgrounds, different cultures, different ethnicities, yeah. and it opened his horizons. And so I think there is more to it than simply getting a degree.
Yeah. yeah.
Anybody who wants to do it should do it, but anybody who doesn't want to do it should have an equally valid path going ahead. But I think, you know, we're so far away from that now in our education system, unfortunately, so that's not going to change very quickly.
I mean now there's a stigma attached to not going, which seems to me to be absolutely repulsive and also absurd.
And
it troubles me because what it means is, because it's so culturally entrenched now, kids who don't go to university automatically feel that they're less than, that their prospects are bleak. Mm. And to a certain extent...
Well, their economics it would say that they are
that's
bleak.
That's right. And it's got to the point now where you have to have a degree to get an above living wage job. Mm. And that's the
work
worst...
Work as a barista.
Right. But that's the worst possible reason to go to university is simply to reach sort of the bottom rung of the economic ladder. I mean, the points you mentioned, Fiona, are good reasons, but that's not how it's... That's not what it's become. No, it's become... Oh my God! If I don't go to university, you know, I'm going to flatline. And somehow that tide needs to be turned. Not least because we need an economy that has many skills and functions, not just people. You know, I read history, you know, at university, and I enjoyed it. It served me well, but I can't honestly say that it other than sort of in that sense of I've got a degree.
Well, it helps you to think, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does.
Does that explain the clear difference between the thinking
levels?
Can I tell you that when I was a graduate trainee journalist, it was just when the journalism was changing from the people, the route that you took to graduates. And I was one of three graduates, I think, in the newsroom of the Daily Express in the early 1980s. So I was working for 4 years with people who'd gone through your route. They were way, way smarter and more streetwise and funnier. And
Well, I mean, I would point out, if there are any young people listening to this podcast, right, that I went to a university and then became a fellow of an Oxford college, right, and I worked for MAP enlightened despotism that is the new European, right? That's so kids, you know, don't drink the Kool-Aid.
The reason that's still the case is because we don't have the other routes that have status, and so all these politicians are talking, until you get the colleges have got status, they've got the funding, they've got the teachers. We just don't have the teachers to teach any of these things. T-levels, most of them can't get off the ground because there aren't enough people to teach them. We haven't got enough teachers to teach, you know, pre-sixth formers maths at the moment, or physics, or, you know, geography. So it's all a bit pie in the sky. And I think, so when I hear all this talk, I think it's, and on one level, I think it's great, but it's so far removed from the day-to-day problems that schools are facing. So in a way, you've got to kind of deal with those basics too and have a bigger aspiration to create a different system.
You were kind of, you know, you saw the new Labour government at first hand up close, and how it, the move from opposition to government, which is obviously huge. When you were watching this week, we're watching Starmer, did you feel, okay, so we all know that they're trying to build a sense of bubbling hope without frightening the horses, and we all get that, but did you feel underneath the kind of playing it safe, there is a kind of, there is a coiled spring which will leap into action and do the kind of things you're talking about. So we had, for example, when Rachel Reeves said that this was the end of globalization as we know it, I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, remembering Blair in 05 saying, you know, as summer goes into autumn, there's no getting away from globalization. I paraphrase. So that, you know, that's a change. But is it, or is it, is that just a, is it just a clever line?
I don't think I've seen enough kind of interesting ideas to come out to feel confident that it's going to be a bubbling spring. It could be. But I don't think I've seen that. Until this week, I hadn't really got a sense from Keir really about where he was going, I don't think. And he would admit that. You know, he's gone his three stages of development and the third one is, you know, why Labour? I don't feel that policy is, you know, interesting policy ideas. I think they're interested in winning, which is great. Of course, you need to win first before you have the policy ideas. But I worry that what will happen in government, you could easily get sunk into a sort of quagmire of just trying to firefight all these problems that do exist, and they are many. Not that there weren't problems in 97 in education, there were serious problems, but a lot of them were to do with investment. But actually, if you go through Labour's period in office, I mean, the stuff they came out with on education was phenomenal. It was a phenomenal sort of, but you had people like Blunkett driving it through, yes, and Adonis driving it through. I mean, they just, some of it I didn't agree with, but some of it was fantastic. And then Gove came in and just basically picked it all apart.
Do you think Starmer's team understands that in office, being sensible won't be enough, that the challenges of the moment are so dramatic and radical and global and new that just being not Tory, being sensible, being reassuring, as important as all that is and welcome as that would be, is necessary but not sufficient?
Well, I mean, it could be enough. I mean, so people say to me, oh, it's fine, people will just be happy to have somebody who's boring and competent.
Initially,
maybe they will be.
Initially.
But I really think we've got to such a bad place in this country on so many areas. And it wasn't like that in 97, that it's just not going to cut it. It's, I mean, got to be high action, and I'm afraid it's going to have to be investment too. I don't see how you solve some of these problems without pouring money into them.
No.
I just don't agree. I don't see it.
And that will involve inevitably borrowing to invest, and I think at some point wealth taxes, but yeah. I understand why.
Well, I'm always in favour of a wealth tax. But when I hear people say, and I hear a lot of governors say, oh, you know, the election, you know, let's just leave it to next year because there'll be an election, you know, they will come in. Well, what do they think is going to happen? Nothing very dramatic that's going to change your local school, I don't think, very quickly. I mean, it could do ultimately, but because the situation there, particularly with teacher recruitment, that is a massive problem. People never talk about it. I mean, a country that cannot recruit enough people to teach us, children is failing, in my view. And yeah, we haven't got enough people. I met a teacher the other day who worked in a school where they've got somebody who hasn't got a GCSE maths teaching GCSE maths. I mean, would you put up with that for your kids?
Is that to do with remuneration or the conditions of work, or
conditions
a combination
of work?
Conditions of
yeah.
work?
Yeah. I mean, there is a serious problem with recruitment. They're not even coming into the graduate
yes.
pathways now. But they're often not staying beyond 4 or 5 years. And that's all to do with Ofsted and the pressure and the, you know, tick boxes and all the things we hear about all the time but never get resolved. But if you got rid of GCSEs and went to a baccalaureate, you see,
yes.
you could open up that whole period of secondary education and take all that, change that accountability and open it up to other things like, you know, drama and music and art. And obviously you've got to do maths and English and your other subjects and have some form of assessment. But who needs to do 11 exams at 16? It's mad.
One of the other topics that he's touched on is private schools
yeah.
and the government's relationship and attitude towards private schools, and talking about putting VAT on school fees. Is that enough? What problem does that solve?
Well,
squeezing a bit more
probably out? Not, but I think in the grand, if you see them as part of a system rather than as some newspapers like to see them as the biggest thing in the world, you know, it's going to ruin the private system. Well, I mean, it's only a tiny little cog in the whole education system, isn't it? And I think it's quite a good way to deal with that. And it sends a signal to people that we're more on the side of the 93% than the 7%. I don't think it's going to make that much difference. And I don't think it's worth the political energy of going any further.
And then, so are you saying actually there's a bigger problem if you're looking at egalitarianism in education?
Well, didn't Gordon Brown want to equalise funding between state and private schools? I remember him saying
yeah.
that at one point. I remember thinking that would be like the fourth road bridge that his house overlooks. You know, you just get across to the other side, the private schools have put the fees up, and you have to come all the way back
yes.
and do it again.
But is the bigger problem then the sort of almost random difference between state schools in
well,
communities?
It's more than... I mean, the trouble is, it's when I was at school, it wasn't that big a difference.
Yeah.
And in the Blair years, it wasn't that big a difference. Now it's a yawning gap.
How has that happened then?
Because they put their fees up and up and up, and they can attract...
No, I didn't mean that. I meant the difference between state schools and the different ways that you have to apply to get your kid into state schools, and the sort of the different application processes that mean that some people living near to an excellent state school get an equivalent of a private education. Some parents living near to a rubbish school get a crap education.
Yeah.
How, when we're talking about the what's in control of the government to fix, surely that equalising the quality of education across
that's why I've always been in favour of comprehensive education. I mean, you've got to have you should be moving towards a system where most schools had a more evenly banded intake of pupils.
Right.
So you didn't have these.
So how do you get that?
You get rid of the grammar schools, you stop the faith schools doing all their, you know, bell ringing tests and whatever. And, you know, you stop these academies who can then set their own admissions criteria, so they pick certain primary schools.
Yeah.
All that needs to be cleaned up. That needs to be cleaned up. And personally, I would say that no school can be outstanding, although I know Labour are getting rid of they say they're getting rid of the Ofsted grades, which I agree with. But if no school should be outstanding unless it has an intake that represents its local community.
Right, right.
Because you've got fantastic discrepancies between schools that are literally half a mile apart.
No, totally.
No.
We're going through it. We've been going through it, you know, for years now. But there are two or three schools in our area that you're desperate to get into. Yeah. But the criteria for each of those schools are different.
Yeah.
And it just feels...
That's diversity, you see, in
action. It's weird. Yeah, it just feels weird.
Well, that's another problem. Yeah. But that, as I say, when you get... There is so... School segregation in this country, particularly in cities, is a serious problem. But and that's another thing to tackle.
There was very good primary school in there I used to live in, where the primary catchment area was 110 metres.
Mm.
And the houses in that area had at least a £50,000, probably now £100,000 premium.
Mm.
Because, so in fact, the intake was overwhelmingly middle to upper middle class.
Yeah.
That can't be right, obviously, but it involves a series of considerable policy shifts, doesn't it?
Incentives, if you made the incentives different on schools, you couldn't be good or outstanding unless you were taking in a representative sample of your local kids. I think that would be quite a simple way to deal with it.
But don't you think then that the schools...
But then that's anti-aspirational parents, isn't it?
But also, I think that would attract some sort of kudos from people, like, oh, they're outside the system because they don't, you know, because they are more selective.
I don't know. I think that Ofsted banner thing, that Ofsted good and outstanding, is really quite a powerful symbol in the education system. So I think that could work. And then you could have lottery. I mean, some schools have lotteries, so they take children from... But it is quite stunning if you look at the segregation figures, and quite shocking, and that shouldn't be allowed to continue. No.
So just to round things up a bit, what if you were giving Keir Starmer a report card as he's about to go into a general election year, what would be the areas where he's doing well, and what would be the areas where he needs to work a bit harder?
Well, obviously he's done spectacularly well in terms of reforming the Labour Party and making it look like... I mean, I don't know anybody who doesn't think Labour's going to win. Well, that may have problems in itself, that sort of sense.
Most of them are in the Tory cabinet.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But the last thing I knew nobody thought we were going to lose was the Brexit referendum, of course. So
true. But think about that night in 2019. I mean, that was bleak beyond belief, wasn't it, really?
Yeah.
That sense that could Labour ever come back from that? And now it's on the brink of coming back from that. Now, that is a lot to do with the Tories being so unspeakably bad. I mean, last week, how they got that so badly wrong, I just can't...
It takes quite a lot of skill.
They had such an opportunity there, didn't they? But I mean, it was just horrific. Everything wrong.
No, you're not.
Everything went wrong. And their conspiracy theories and HS2, it's just awful. So I don't think they can do it, really. But so I think that in that sense, very good. But I think, and I can understand the thing about not having much policy. And Alistair always reminds me that, you know, 96, did Labour have many policies? Not really.
For the three people who don't know, that's Alistair Campbell, who is your partner.
I keep looking back to see they didn't really have many specific policies. But I think they knew what they wanted to do. I think Blunkett had a pretty clear idea of what he wanted to do when he became educator.
Yes, the direction of travel was very clear. And it was very clearly
standards, not structures.
Briefed as well, that you knew.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing I keep going back to is that remembering that period and the energy coming out of, you know, Gordon's office, Tony's office, you know, New Labour thinkers. It was a milieu. It was amazing. It kind of hit you when you walked in. I don't get that from this team at all.
No, I agree with that. I mean, I think they were very hungry. They'd been in opposition for a long time. And people underestimate that, how formative those Kinnock years were for all those people who were in the shadow cabinet. I mean, they were very good at churning stuff out all the time. They were always looking for stories. They were always thinking. I don't see that now. It all feels a bit kind of like it's a different type of person that's going into politics, I think, as well.
Well, the two that remind me of that era in a kind of micro way are Wes Streeting and Peter Kyle, who are very much a unit, and they operate together in a way that Blair and Brown did then. Mm. But they're not leading the party. You know?
But so it remains to be seen. I mean, I think you could easily get submerged quite quickly between people's expectations and your lack of ability to do much about it. And then you get things like, you know, the rat crisis, and something like that engulfs the government very, very quickly, doesn't it? And also the other thing I was thinking the other day, I just really wonder about the quality and the number of civil servants who are left. I mean, I don't know, but I think when Labour came in, there was a fully functioning civil service.
There was.
I'm not sure that's the case now. So they're going to be quite dependent on the people who actually get things done.
Well, the trouble is, you know, the incentive to hang around when you've got people like Dominic Raab talking about activist civil servants with impunity, it gets smaller and smaller, and they can't fight back.
Mm. But you need them to be able to enforce.
Absolutely. They're crucial.
Implement
stuff. You know, Rishi Sunak talks in his conference speech about the permanent state. Well, that's as close to the deep state as you can get.
Yeah, I know. So I worry about all those things, and whether I could see them getting engulfed quite quickly with stuff and not really anticipating it. I mean, I don't think anybody knew in 97 what it was going to be like moving into government, but I think actually they handled it amazingly well, had some fantastic people around them, and Tony just had this incredible drive and energy and determination to do certain things.
He's your MP, isn't he, Koo? Is he?
He is at the moment, but he won't be after the election.
But do you ever bump into him in the street?
Yeah.
What do you say to him?
Well, hello. You know, we talk about this and that. And I see Vic Moat quite a lot.
Is he a nice guy?
He's a really nice guy. I like him a lot.
Sincere? Yeah,
he's a very nice guy. They're both lovely people.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you a member of the party?
No.
Were you? Are you an ex-member? Yeah.
Yeah, I left. But I don't feel particularly drawn to going back. And I try and analyse why that is. I think one reason is that I'm unresolved about Brexit, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And I know quite a lot of people are still very unhappy about that.
For sure.
And I quite like not being a party member because I can come on things like this and I don't have to worry about retweeting something and being kicked out of the Labour Party, which seems to be a ridiculous development.
No, but it's a...
it's ridiculous.
It's a jeopardy you could do without.
Yeah. Why can't I be... You know, I don't want to feel I can't say what I think because somebody from high command is going to come down and say we're reporting you to some committee about...
Well, I hope you come on and say what you think
Please.
In future again. It was great.
Okay, well, I look forward to it. It'd be fun when Labour get into power, won't it?
Well, we definitely must do it on the other side, yeah.
Absolutely. One side of the bridge, if not before.
Yeah. Fiona Millett, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Fiona, and that's it for today's show. Get your questions in and any feedback you might have to the 2MATS, that's the number 2, MATTS, at tnepublishing.co.uk. That's 2MATS at tnepublishing.co.uk. And a reminder, our special deal, head to the neweuropean.co.uk/2MATS for a superb deal on a New European subscription. And there's a link in the show notes. Thank you as ever to our producer, the third Matt, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And until next week.
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.